And she's right. Okay, let me repeat this for the TV audience there. She's saying, starting from, you know, Proverbs 22, 22 and 23, do not exploit the poor because they're poor. Do not crush the needy in court, for the Lord will take up their case and will plunder those who plunder them. Jennifer's comment is that she holds a job where they are in the business of extracting money from people who owe it in some way and taking perhaps legal action to do that, right? And so how do you deal in a situation like that? How do you remain true to Scripture and the calling of Scripture in that kind of situation? What do you think? Sandra has an idea. Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah, to condense that comment, which is a good one, I think hits the nail on the head. There's a difference between exploitation and collecting money that is owed. Okay? And so I don't think it would be right to say, well, on the sly, I'm going to start forgiving all kinds of debt until I lose my job. You know, that wouldn't be the way to handle it. But justice should be served. And so if people have bought something on time and they've run out of time, then, you know, you need to get, they should pay what they owe. Now, if you encounter a worthy case where they've really had to suffered some ill fortune and some illness or whatever, and you see that these are genuine, honest, worthy people who are in trouble, then you might take note of them and try to bring some help to them, not by forgiving the debt they owe your company and thus being disloyal to your job, but by perhaps alerting a church or some individuals that could help of this particular need. That's, I think, the way to handle it, keeping the two issues a bit separate. Now, the other question that came up was, let me see if I can remember exactly how you put this. How do we know if we feel that we should be helping the poor more than we are? We can't help everybody all at once. How do we go about deciding? How do we prioritize our actions? How do we go about doing something since we can't do everything? Who's got an idea on that one? I'm not going to call on Sandra again because she could teach this class better than I can. But I want to give other people a chance. Anyone? Yes, you haven't had a hand up today. Right. Okay. Yeah. Several things combined there. She's commenting on an experience she had in India, where and those who've been in third world situations really know what it is to have a press around you of all kinds of needy people. And there's, you know, you could empty your pitiful wallet and you wouldn't even begin to scratch the surface, and the crowds would begin to swell. And there, you need to, I think, reflect on how can I best help in this situation. I was in a similar situation in Uganda where, you know, what I could have offered monetarily would not have been perhaps rightly applied in, you know, if I just started pulling out bills and such. And I needed to remember that what I was there for, you know, I was there for a spiritual service, which is really more important in that situation. And Christians said it was more important than monetary aid. And yet, we also had to be wise in terms of even giving out our address and say, you know, we will work through certain leaders in the churches. You know, so you do have to be wise. But I guess what I learned was, I don't want to just erect a barrier and say poor people deserve to be that way. They, you know, that's not the case. And that to say that is sometimes to dishonor their maker. Yes. Right, yeah, the comment there is that it's far more valuable to teach people how to fish than it is to simply give them a plate of fish, which will eventually be exhausted, and then you know, then they have nothing. But if they learn to fish, they can supply themselves. Prime example of that, I have a friend, a British friend, who grew up in Kenya and is very interested in the continent of Africa and has spent some time there. And he worked for the World Bank, too, so he knew financial things and such. And he said one of the problems during, you remember the Ethiopian crisis, one of the problems with some of the milk products that were sent down there, they sent down powdered milk and such, and sometimes there would arrive a glut of milk powder that would do two things. It would put any struggling milk industry immediately out of business, because of course immediately milk would have no value because it just gotten this huge shipment of milk. So anybody who was trying to get a dairy business going would immediately be put out of business. And then he said, secondly, a lot of times they'd end up lining their soccer fields with this milk powder. You know, they had more milk powder than they needed. What they really needed was help in establishing themselves. They didn't need so much the handout as a help in establishing themselves. So he spent his time going around doing training on crop rotation and the proper use of fertilizers and such. So we want to be wise in what we do. I'm sorry, I got to move on here. Is that all right? Sorry, guys. Okay. Well, let's just touch on a few more themes, and we got to get out of these first nine chapters. We got a lot of other chapters to cover yet. And again, I'm picking things that particularly speak to me. So there are other themes here, and they may not be the ones. You may say, why'd you leave out that one? That's the one that spoke to me. Well, I'm the teacher, so I can choose ones I like. Well, one of them that I particularly like, and you can bring yours up in the questions too. One that really strikes me is what I call teachability. And after that last comment, I'm the teacher and I can choose what I like, this is kind of ironic that I'm going to talk about teachability. But look at chapter 9, beginning in verse 7. Whoever corrects a mocker invites insult. Whoever rebukes a wicked man incurs abuse. Do not rebuke a mocker or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. Instruct a wise man and he will be wiser still. Teach a righteous man and he will add to his learning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For through me your days will be many, and years will be added to your life. If you are wise, your wisdom will reward you. If you are a mocker, you alone will suffer. Well, I'm really keying on that first portion there. That contrasts a wise person and a mocker. A mocker does not receive rebuke well. A wise person does. That is to say, a wise person is teachable. Let's look at one other verse, chapter 17, verse 10. A rebuke impresses a man of discernment more than 100 lashes a fool. The reason this speaks to me is I realize that there are temptations in our lives to think that I can learn certain things from certain people. I could learn a lot from some people, and the temptation is to think, and from some other people I can learn very little. And that is a mistake. There's also a sense of feeling, you know, I've arrived, you know, I have a MAGTS or an MAC or an MDiv or whatever. I've arrived now, and I'm the one who knows the stuff, and I don't really learn from people who haven't achieved this qualification or whatever. That is a grave mistake, and that's a sign of a lack of wisdom. We should be open and teachable, open to rebuke. Now, there's a right way to rebuke. There's a right way to correct. There's a right way to make constructive criticism. The adjective is constructive, speaking the truth in love. So we want to do it that, you know, when we're dealing with one another, we want to do it in that spirit. But a wise person is open to that and is thankful. A rebuke impresses a man of discernment more than 100 lashes a fool. And we need to be, how can we receive that kind of thing in my own life? I think I have to be secure enough in the Lord, not in who I am, but in the Lord, that someone can say, you know, I don't like the way you're doing this, or I think you're erring in this area. And I can say, you're right. Yeah, I take that point. I'll try to improve. I'm not perfect. God accepts me. Remember those buttons that we older teenagers used to wear? Please be patient with me. God is not finished with me yet. I see a few of you people smiling. You're giving yourselves away if you've heard of those, because those are back in the 60s. But that's true. God is not finished with us yet. And we should be willing to receive that rebuke and appreciate it when it's constructively given. I remember when we were in Germany having a thought. The thought suddenly strikes me. I may have said this already in class far earlier. Did I talk about just coming from learning German? No? Okay. Then I'll talk about it briefly, just as kind of an illustration of this point. Right after I got out of language school in Germany, my German was not great, you can imagine. Okay, I had a lot of passive knowledge that I'd learned in the classroom, but I hadn't had to activate a lot of it. And yet, as I listened to older missionaries speak, because I had just been studying all the grammar, I could pick out their grammatical errors, the ones that they made consistently. You know, he's using this preposition, he's using it with the wrong case. You know, he's using the dative case instead of the accusative case. Because I had just been studying that. Now, it would never in a million years have dawned on them to ask me for help with their German. You know, they were the ones who were fluent, and I was the one who needed help. It wouldn't have dawned on them to think they needed to be teachable by me. But I, sitting there, I could see their flaws. Now, sometimes we older Christians need to realize that the younger Christians, the babes in Christ, to whom it's all fresh and new, could correct us and remind us of the basics and let us know that we've been practicing some wrong, you know, we've been conjoining the wrong preposition with the wrong case for some long time now. And so we need to be teachable. And that's, once we realize that that's what God wants us to be, then that makes it a whole lot easier to receive criticism. Now, sometimes people criticize us in hurtful ways, and we need to have the courage then to say, I take your point, but could you say it in love? And that's fair enough, too. But teachability is a theme that, look for that and write it in your margin when you see things that call us to be teachable. A couple of other things. Of course, there's an emphasis work and the wonderful images of the sluggard in chapter 6. I won't go over those at this point. I've mentioned also dissension and how that's sort of the acceptable Christian sin sometimes to sow words of dissension. We need to be very careful about that because that's the seventh of the seven things the Lord hates. Remember? And also in Paul's lists, both in Romans 13 and in Galatians 5, of the worst of sins, dissension is right there in their midst, the sowing of dissension. That is a theme that comes up in these. There's also something in these early chapters that reminds me of the Song of Songs. That's a book that we will get to yet this semester. Look at chapter 5, beginning in verse 15. This sounds, if we didn't know it was from the book of Proverbs, you might even think this is from that Solomon's Song of Songs. Beginning in verse 15, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Should your springs overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth, a loving doe, a graceful deer. May her breasts satisfy you always. May you be ever captivated by her love. Why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the bosom of another man's wife? For a man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all his paths. The evil deeds of a wicked man ensnare him. The cords of his sin hold him fast. He will die for lack of discipline, led astray by his own great folly. Now, what interests me in this is this whole notion. It's talking about the wife of your youth, okay? That woman you married, or that man, I think we can reverse this and also talk about, when we're going to talk about your husband's breasts, you know, you can trust me there, but I think we can reverse the imagery in some way, if that's all right. And it actually says, I'm sorry I put that on film, you can edit that if you like.
Rewind.
Yeah, rewind, you can't do that. But listen to what it says. It says, it doesn't say, learn to live with her, learn to live with him, get along with him, you're in it for the long haul. Everyone knows that marriage is a lot of work, and a lot of pain, a lot of toil, and everyone knows that it goes from the honeymoon down from there. You know, it doesn't use that kind of imagery. It's not sort of like, it's your duty, so do it. It says, may you ever be captivated by her love. Now, the question is, how can that happen? How can we actually be captivated by the love of this person that we live with all the time? There's no easy answer to that, of course. But I think it begins with respecting that person, really showing love to that person, loving according to 1 Corinthians 13, accentuating the positive. You know, I know that my wife could look at me, and I know there are things that I do that bug her. And she could have focused on my foibles, and my molehills would now be mountains. And I could have done the same with her. But by God's grace, you know, I think we have learned to appreciate. You know, she has learned to dislike hair. You know, she said, I don't like men with hair. You know, I know she's lying, but I love it when she lies that way. You know, but you can focus on the negatives, or you can focus on the positives and watch what God can do. You know, in terms of strengthening the strengths. You know, and there's nothing more delightful than to think, you know, not only has she been good for me, but I've been good for her. And really, love can grow. Howard Hendricks talks about his intimacy with his wife and his first 20 years of marriage as a 20-year warm-up. Now, that is not the wisdom of the world. The world says it does go from bad to worse. You know, at best, you end up in a silent sort of cold war, and you just stick it out because you're a dutiful person. But that's not what this says. It's be captivated by her love. And that's what we should strive for. Yes, Matt. Okay, I'm going to condense this, and I may or may not succeed in getting exactly what you're talking about. But the idea that I think Matt is bringing up here is, it is quite easy to, because of the various things we read in the book of Proverbs, it's quite easy to take them, certain ones at face value, and misapply them. You know, how do you both exercise rebuke and receive rebuke without that getting over into dissension, for instance? And so what is the regulative principle that enables us to draw on them rightly? Good question. We'll come to that in just a minute, okay? Because when we talk about what a proverb is, I think that's the key. What is a proverb? How do we apply it? So we need to get there yet, okay? Okay, so that section, I love that one. And let me say one more thing about it. If this is not enough, you know, the notion of the wonder of a captivating relationship, which is possible. If that's not enough to attract us to it, we do have the reminder in verse 21, "For a man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all his paths. And the evil deeds of a wicked man ensnare him. The cords of his sin hold him fast. He will die for lack of discipline, led astray by his own great folly." I don't think there are many who have engaged in sin who later are glad. Our sins, what we think, our exercise of freedom, does end up ensnaring us. I was talking to a young man in my office even this week who was sort of lamenting the way a certain thing had gone, and he felt a little guilty for some things that had gone on. And you could tell that if he could erase that past, he would very readily do it, and life would be far simpler. The book of Proverbs says the evil deeds of a wicked man ensnare him. I'm not calling this friend of mine a wicked man. I'm just using that as an illustration to say we really can weave a tangled web. And so the temptations of sin, we should look beyond the immediate gratification that they appear to present to realize where that will all lead and how the difficulty that will be ours in unraveling it, to say nothing of the fact that our ways are in full view of the Lord. And just, you know, while we're on the subject of marriage, just don't underestimate your weakness, those of you who are married. Don't think that, wow, that could never happen to me, because anything can happen to any of us but for God's grace. And sometimes, you know, I read a very tragic story of a Christian minister who was attracted to a young woman in his congregation, but he knew that she would never be interested in him. It just couldn't happen. And so he allowed himself to spend some time with her on working on different projects and, you know, and get to know her and enjoy her company and so forth, because he knew that she was the safety. She was the guard. She was the gate. She would stop him. You know, she would never be interested in him. Well, the problem was he one day discovered, to his sort of frightened surprise and partial delight, that she was in fact interested in him. The problem was, by that point, he was leaning toward her like this, see, expecting her to hold him from falling. And when she opened the gate even a crack, he fell. Yeah, so don't underestimate your weakness. Keep those safeguards, keep those fences well erected. Oh well, I could go on about that, but you probably know a whole lot more about these things than I do. Especially you guys that are in the MAC program, you've already studied some of this stuff. Well, let's move on to the next section, which is Proverbs chapter 10, beginning in verse 1. This is the section that is comprised of almost exclusively sentence sayings, the little short sentence sayings. Furthermore, in the first five chapters, actually six chapters, 10 to 15, we have a large proportion of what we earlier learned are antithetical parallelisms. Notice how, if you just look at your Bible, how the second half of each verse begins with "but." You know, and that's indicative of an antithetical parallelism. First verse, "A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son grief to his mother. This, but that. This, but that. Righteous, but wicked. Wise, but foolish." And so it goes through the first six chapters up to the end of chapter 15. Now, many have tried to discover an overarching picture, an overarching structure for these chapters, not only the up through 15, but the whole section, chapter 10 all the way to 22:16. That's called the Solomonic collection. Notice the title is The Proverbs of Solomon. And I used to have students try to outline this book, and they really got frustrated when they got into this section, because they said, "How can I outline this? It's just one thing and then another thing and then another thing," and that's true of all the chapters. Well, it is a little frustrating and it is difficult. And some are convinced that we will never find any kind of coherent overarching structure. Remember, we talked about the book of Proverbs, especially this section, as being kind of a multivitamin, okay, where you get a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of the other thing in every chapter. And that remains true to this day. But the question is that all there is to be said? One does occasionally sense some kind of purposeful arrangement as we're reading through this, some sense that the Proverbs are not merely random. That there do seem to be these little mini groupings, and sometimes there almost seems to be what I call vicinity repetition. In other words, one thing will be said, and then maybe something else will be said in between, and then it'll come back to that earlier theme. It's not that they're just grouped tightly together, but there's what may be a vicinity repetition taking place. Let me give you a couple of examples. In chapter 15, beginning in verse 13, 15 beginning with 13, notice the repetition here. A happy heart makes the face cheerful, but heartache crushes the spirit. A discerning heart seeks knowledge, but the mouth of a fool feeds on folly. All the days of the oppressed are wretched, but the cheerful heart has a continual feast. Notice the repetition of heart. That seems to be intentional. One saying reminded the compiler, reminded the one who put this all together, of another proverb relating to heart and so forth, and they were then joined together. Another example would be chapter 16, verses 20 to 23. Whoever gives heed to instruction prospers, and blessed is he who trusts in the Lord. Here we have teachability again. The wise in heart are called discerning, and pleasant words promote instruction. Understanding is a fountain of life to those who have it, but folly brings punishment to fools. A wise man's heart guides his mouth, and his lips promote instruction. What is repeated there? Instruction, okay? That word in particular is repeated a number of times. So it's obviously there's kind of a little chain of related proverbs given there. And I could give many other examples of that. What this does is raise the question of whether the collection is really just a grab bag where someone dumped all the sayings into a hat and then pulled them out willy-nilly, or whether there is not a purposeful arrangement to these proverbs. And that's an important question. You might say, well, what's the difference? Well, what would be the difference? If we discover that the proverbs are purposely arranged, how would that affect our interpretation? Okay, we could look for themes. Yeah, Steve? Okay, context would need to be considered in a different way. You know, you'd think if someone purposely juxtaposed this proverb to this next proverb to this next proverb, then what is the purpose in that juxtaposition? How does my understanding of the third one, how is it affected by the one that went before and the one that went before that? Rather than saying there's no sense, there's no structure, there's no intentionality to this arrangement, so each is an isolated tidbit. And the only context I can have for understanding this one is to find other sayings that touch on that same theme and collect them together as I did with personal property, you know, Proverbs on personal property. Now, what I want us to do at this juncture is to take about, let's see, I want us to take about 15 minutes maximum to break up into our small groups. I try to do this from time to time so you can talk to each other. With my permission, and if you would look at chapter 10, which is the very beginning of this section, chapter 10 verses 1 to 11. And what I want you to do there is to read those chapters together in a group, and then to reflect on whether there is an apparent purposeful arrangement to these verses, and if there is, what it is and what its significance might be. Okay, now recalling that this is in that section that is generally regarded as just a haphazard collection, this, that, and the other thing, rather thrown together. I want you to see if that's what you find here, chapter 10, verses 1 to 11. And we'll stop when the big hand reaches the 2, and that will, then we'll debrief, and then we'll take a break. Okay, well, your task, whether or not you chose to accept it, was to look at chapter 10, verses 1 to 11, and ask whether there seem to be indications of an intentional structuring, an intentional arrangement of these particular verses, because, after all, it does appear on the surface to be just a little bit of this and a little bit of that, one thing after another, perhaps unrelated. Now, as I was cruising from group to group, I didn't see a great deal of discovery there. I saw some, you know, and people were working diligently, but maybe this is a little harder than I thought. And actually, I've read an article on this, and in fact, I'll tell you the name of the article, and I dare you to read it. Let's see. Wait a minute. The way this, if I can find the name. Yeah, it's by a fellow I met whose name is Knut Heim. He's a German, and it's written in English, thankfully. And the article is entitled "Co-referentiality, Structure, and Context in Proverbs 10, 1 to 5." Okay, so that lets you know the title's simpler than the text. Anyway, so I did have a little bit of an advantage in seeking some of these things out, because I was more or less testing his theory for those first five verses. But the bottom line, I think, and you'll have to take this on faith if you didn't get that far to discovering some of these things, the bottom line is there seems to be an increasing sense on the part of people who are really studying this section of an intentional structuring to the section. I think if we look, first of all, for repeated words or phrases, such as we have in verses 1 and 5. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son grief to his mother. When you get to 5, he who gathers crops in summer is like a wise son, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son. All right, now, when you encounter that in the Old Testament, often there's what we call inclusio, or an envelope structure, where you sort of end where you began. You begin with one thing and then you end with that, so as to sort of encompass or envelop a little unit. So that's a trigger to think maybe this is some kind of unit. Now notice that the wise son is described in verse 1 as bringing joy to the father and grief to his mother. Now verse 5, we're talking about wise and disgraceful sons still, but notice in verse 5 it's talking about the wise son gathering crops in summer. But he who sleeps in harvest is a disgraceful son. So this wisdom, according to verse 5, the wise son is displaying his wisdom in his industry and in his timely ingathering of crops. Now the question is there any relationship between that and the intervening verses? Well, look at verse 2. Ill-gotten treasures are of no value, but righteousness delivers from death. All right. Well, maybe that's addressed to the wise son as well. Talking about about gain, about treasures. Look at verse 4. Lazy hands make a man poor, but diligent hands bring wealth. Okay? Treasures in verse 2, wealth in verse 4. Seems to be talking about, you know, that whole issue of what is ill-gotten, what is well-gotten, how it's gotten through diligence. There does seem to be something of a relationship. And in this article I read, he goes in and he rings all the changes on that and shows it terminologically and in terms of theme and so forth, and works from the Hebrew text. And so you'll have to trust me on some of that there is a greater relationship than is at first apparent. But notice we're getting kind of a structure. We've got 1 and 5 more or less paralleling each other, 2 and 4 to some extent paralleling each other, and what's in the middle? Verse 3. Thank you. Yes, half credit on the test, okay, for that one. Yeah, verse 3. But notice in the middle, but the Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. So what are we talking about there? Well, again, it's talking about gain, provision, receiving what you need, talking about the satisfaction of hunger. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry. And so notice that in this little unit, if that's what it is, at the very middle is a focus on the Lord. Okay, so it is a chiasm. Yeah, it's A, B, and then the X, the center, the central fulcrum, the most important thing to focus on, and then B, A. That's what we call a chiasm or chiasm. Now, what this means then is as you interpret these proverbs, if you discern that unit, then context suddenly becomes relevant. Then it's worth looking at what is the relationship between these proverbs that otherwise appear to just be juxtaposed. Now, very quickly, looking on to, and I think what I'll do, if it's all right with our taper back there, I may just go for another 10 or 15 minutes and then stop. Okay, we'll end early, and so we will just skip that break. Is that going to work, Christy? Is that all right? Okay. Is that all right with you guys? You just get off early, okay? Hold me to it. Okay, I'm sure you will. If you look at verse 6 going on, we again encounter a lot of repetition. Blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked. We noticed that there were some different translations of that. The Hebrew word is actually covers. It's the same. So blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence covers the mouth of the wicked. So maybe we ought to translate it that way. The memory of the righteous will be a blessing, but the name of the wicked will rot. The wise in heart accept commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin. The man of integrity walks securely, but he who takes crooked paths will be found out. He who winks maliciously causes grief, and a chattering fool comes to ruin. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but violence covers the mouth of the wicked. Now there again you see clear sort of envelope structure where it began with this phrase, violence covers the mouth of the wicked, in verse 6. Then in verse 11, violence covers the mouth of the wicked. Verse 6 at the beginning, blessings crown the head of the righteous. Verse 11, the mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life. Okay, so it does seem that there's some kind of a unit perhaps going on. And inside that, we have reference to the chattering fool coming to ruin. And then in the center of that, we have in verse 9 the reference to the man of integrity walks securely, but he who takes crooked paths will be found out. Now, we could go ahead and explore that, but to me that suggests some kind of intentionality to the structuring. If you then were to go on, which I'll do just ever so briefly, in verse 12, notice that verse 12 says, hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrongs. Now remember the verb rendered in the NIV, overwhelms, is actually covers. Violence covers the mouth of the wicked. Then verse 12, hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrong. You have sort of a linguistic chaining together, a catchword device, it's sometimes called, so that it appears that verse 12 and the unit, maybe if there is a unit that it introduces, is intentionally linked to what went before. A little linguistic link. And verse 12, then, I think there's another chiasm perhaps, because verse 12, hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrongs, reminds me or sounds the same as what we come to in verse 18, he who covers his hatred, the NIV translates it conceals, but the word again is the same, covers. He who covers his hatred has lying lips, but whoever spreads slander is a fool. Notice again that you have hatred and covers in verse 12, and again in 18, covers his hatred has lying lips. And that's suggestive of a unit. Verses 13 and 14 talk about wisdom is found on the lips of the discerning, but a rod is for the back of him who lacks judgment. Wise men store up knowledge, but the mouth of a fool invites ruin. Then verse 17, he who heeds discipline shows the way of life, but whoever ignores correction leads others astray. There seems to be some thematic parallelism there. And then at the center of that, we have this very interesting juxtaposition of verses 15 and 16. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city, but poverty is the ruin of the poor. Before we go on to the next, I mean, if we just read that, that's an observation as a statement of apparent fact, but it's sort of, and that's probably a saying that would have been known, but it's sort of then qualified or corrected in verse 16, the wages of the righteous bring them life, but the income of the wicked brings them punishment. The idea being that, yeah, the rich may view their wealth as a fortified city, and the poor, yes, view their poverty as their ruin. But in fact, wealth or poverty is not so much the issue. Rather, the wages of the righteous brings them life. I was saying in the break to someone that, you know, Jesus promised abundant life, and he's hardly in a position to promise that which he did not experience, and yet he did not have a place to lay his head. So obviously life does not, you know, our lives do not consist in the things that we own. So the rich are mistaken if they think of their wealth as a fortified city. And in fact, it'll come back to this much later. I think it's in chapter 18, verse 11. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city, an unscalable wall they imagine it to be. So again, an interesting sort of later qualification of that. Now, that's I want to stop there and just say that's just a taste of what I think is going to be increasingly becoming apparent as more and more people study these sections with this kind of question in mind. It's a little hard to do without learning Hebrew to do it, because sometimes those catchwords, you need to know the Hebrew to do it. But some of it you can do without that. So I encourage you to look for relationships and not just assume, well, it's haphazard. I don't really think it is, and I think it will become increasingly apparent as people continue to pursue that. Now, any comment or question right there? Yes. Right, very good. In fact, that's in the article. Yeah, it is. Knut Heim also observed that, and he observed verse 1, positive, negative. Verse 2, negative, positive. Verse 3, positive, negative. Verse 4, negative, positive. Verse 5, positive, negative. But then he broke it there, because verse 6 is again positive, negative. So it kind of, it's a little odd, but it broke that alternation in the sense, or is that right? Alternating. It broke that by doing again positive negative. Yeah, good. I'm glad y'all found that. It's in the article. You may want to read it. Yeah, Steve. Good question. The question is, does verse 1 as the beginning of a section create a theme for multiple chapters? Maybe. Maybe. That's a question worth pursuing. The whole address is to, you know, the father enjoining his son to give heed not only to his instruction but to his mother's instruction. And the whole goal is to have a wise son that will bring joy to the father, or to his earthly father. Let me tell you a couple of other things that are fascinating about this section, and I think I will reserve the finishing off of Proverbs for the first session next time. But let me tell you a couple of other things that I find fascinating about this particular section. One is, and I first heard this from Bruce Waltke. It was, I think, discovered by a fellow named Patrick Skian, I think was his name. But he, and this is strange, okay? I admit it, it's strange. But he points out that in this Solomonic collection, 10:1 to 22:16, there are 375 proverbs. Now, why is that of interest? Well, 375 is the numeric value of the name Solomon. So if you assign, if you take the name Solomon in Hebrew, Shlomo, and you assign the number value to each of those letters, it comes out to 375. Now, I know you think I'm weird, but you already thought I was weird, so why worry about it now? But the curious thing about that is that's not the only number that's of significance. And in fact, I don't have it with me, but Roland Murphy in his treatment of this and others have drawn attention. It was really Patrick Skian at first who drew attention to a number of very interesting numeric values in this book. Now, the question arises, is it possible that could be more than just coincidental, that the central Solomonic collection could have this, the number of proverbs that correspond to the numeric value of his name? Is that possible? And that's intentional? I think it's possible, sure. Just because we wouldn't choose to do it that way, by the way, you know, in English, the letters of the English alphabet don't have numeric values assigned. We use Arabic numerals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we don't assign numbers, numeric value, to the letters of our alphabet, but in Hebrew they do. So Aleph is 1 and Beit is 2 and so forth and so on. So I think it's possible, and I think if Solomon is the one who compiled his master collection here, how many proverbs did he write after all? 3,000. And if he were to make a selection, he needs to somehow decide how many. It may well have dawned on Solomon or some later compiler, if a later compiler is actually responsible for this Solomonic collection, to use that as the numeric value. Now, let me point out something else interesting to you. If you look at chapter 16, there's something curious about the first verses in chapter 16, verses 1 to 9. And let me just read them to you, and you tell me what's unusual about them, just from your sense of having read this book. You know, you finished that now. You finished Proverbs now. So tell me what's striking about these particular verses, 1 to 9. To man belong the plans of the heart, but from the Lord comes the reply of the tongue. All a man's ways seem innocent to him, but motives are weighed by the Lord. Commit to the Lord whatever you do, and your plans will succeed. The Lord works out everything for his own ends, even the wicked for a day of disaster. The Lord detests all the proud of heart. Be sure of this, they will not go unpunished. Through love and faithfulness, sin is atoned for. Through the fear of the Lord, a man avoids evil. When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies live at peace with him. Better a little with righteousness than much gain with injustice. In his heart, a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. Again, we're dealing with a bit of a unit here because you notice 1 and 9 pretty much are ringing the same bell, and I think you could work out even a little chiasm here if we were to take time to do it. But what's striking about this particular group of verses? Yeah, Brian. The Lord is mentioned in all but one. Verse 8 is the exception that proves the rule, but that is interesting because on average, in this portion of the book of Proverbs, the name of the Lord, Yahweh, comes up about every 7th or 8th verse. Whereas in this group of 9 verses, the name of the Lord appears in all but one. And why is that significant? Well, curiously enough, this set of 9 verses is pretty much dead center in the Solomonic collection. If you were to count all the verses before it and all the verses after it, you'd find that this section is just right about within one verse of being right in the middle. Okay? Is that significant? Well, yeah, again, I think it is. Just as in 10:1-5, we saw the focus in the middle on the Lord. For this whole collection, there's this concentration on the Lord, simply underscoring what the motto has already said, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. There is more to learn about the book of Proverbs. I remember once when I was working on my degree in Cambridge at a garden party, I think I may have mentioned this in this class, a guy came up to me and asked me what I was working on, and I said, I'm working on in the Old Testament. And he said, is there anything still to be done there? Believe it or not, there is. And there's a lot still to be done here, just in adjusting ourselves and seeing these things and beginning to understand that the way we write is not necessarily the way they would have written. And I think as we do that, we will learn new things. God has more truth to break forth from His Word than we have yet seen. It won't be different truth, but it will be enriching to us. Now, I said I would stop early, so I'm going to stop early. I have baited you all evening talking about what is a proverb. I haven't forgotten. We'll deal with that next time.